Income inequality in the United States has grown steadily over the past three decades, and today, in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, it's more pronounced than ever. The rise of the super-rich, however, has not been confined to the United States. Chrystia Freeland discusses this phenomenon in her latest book called Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. It's published by Penguin Press. Ms. Freeland is the digital editor of Thomson Reuters and has reported for the Financial Times and The Economist. She's also the author of Sale of the Century, The Inside Story of the Second Russian Revolution. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. I'm delighted to be here.
How does the current level of income inequality in the United States compare with other periods in our history?
Well, it's the highest ever. Economists say that it's as high as it was in the Gilded Age, which was the previous high water mark. And some economists think it's even higher than it was then.
Well, the Gilded Age, the wealth was created by the Industrial Revolution. And we understand how some people become rich in those circumstances. We don't have an Industrial Revolution right now, do we?
Well, I think we sort of do. And I think actually that comparison is really valid for exactly that reason. So I think in the Gilded Age, you had the Industrial Revolution, and it created both these huge fortunes and also something we sometimes forget now, which is this huge economic dislocation. There was progress, but there was also poverty. Something quite similar is happening today. And instead of the Industrial Revolution, what we have is the Technology Revolution and globalization. And these are transformations on a global scale, which are creating a global super elite, but are really hollowing out the American middle class.
Well, you have written about the rise of the Russian oligarchs and the fall of communism. And we've seen something similar in China and to some degree in India as well, Brazil. But
Mexico, Carlos Slim, richest guy in the world.
Yeah, but there aren't that many other people who can compare with Carlos Slim in Mexico. He just seems to be living in some other kind of universe. But this is the equivalent of an industrial revolution in those countries, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And what's happening in the emerging markets is really sort of two Gilded Ages at the same time. So those countries, Russia, a little bit different because they had industrialization, but sort of Soviet-style industrialization. So it kind of didn't work that well. I've been to a lot of Soviet factories, and they're definitely, you know, they have massive smelters, but they're not that modern. But in India, in China, in much of Latin America, you're having this great move of urbanization and industrialization. And what you're seeing there in many ways is really similar to the 19th century in the West. Overlaid on top of that is the technology revolution, which means that their industrial revolution is happening in a way which is connected with our own economy.
Was there a form of globalization during the Gilded Age? Or is that something that's new?
No, there was, but not as much. I mean, you know, when you think about transport, when you think about technology, we can now work around the world in a seamless way, which just wasn't possible in the 19th century. You know, we can outsource work to people in India. We can have our iPods or our iPads produced in China and delivered really, really swiftly here. That makes a difference.
Now, we read about these things in our op-ed pages, but it really wasn't all that much of an issue during this recent political campaign, whether we're talking about the presidential candidates or most of the local candidates. Do Americans feel comfortable talking about income inequality in the public sphere?
I think that there is a real discomfort talking about it. I think that there is, you know, and I have found that to even raise these issues is to sort of be accused of being someone who is waging class war, to sort of make the observation that we're seeing increasing income inequality. You know, it goes so much against the way Americans like to see themselves and their country as this land of opportunity, and to say, well, actually, you know, social mobility now in the United States is lower than it is in Western Europe or Canada. That's very threatening to a lot of people.
Well, can't it be argued that this is class warfare from the other side as well? why don't we hear more of that from the left?
Well, I think that's a great point, and actually Warren Buffett has made that point, right? Warren Buffett has said, yeah, it's a class war, and my class is winning. Why don't we hear it more from the left? You know, I think probably we should. I think that the left should be more willing to talk about where the rewards are going and address that squarely. I think part of the problem for the left, though, is do they have solutions? So you spoke, Leonard, about the Industrial Revolution. And if you think about the political response to the Industrial Revolution, the Progressive Era was this tremendously creative, innovative political response, which really invented modern society as we know it. Do you think we're seeing on the left an equally inventive response to these new economic revolutions we're living through? I don't.
Now, the buzzword throughout for both candidates for the presidency was middle class. But I'm not sure what middle class actually means when they're talking. And we don't hear anything about poor people. Have they been the forgotten group, or do we just include them in the bottom of the middle class?
Well, let me take that in turn. I agree with you that poor people are the forgotten people in U.S. politics, and I think that's really shameful. Having said that, if you look at what's happening in the economic data, the interesting thing is the position of the poor relative to where it was in recent decades hasn't changed that much. Where you've seen the real change is in the middle, where middle-class jobs have been really hollowed out, and you see the rise of the working poor, people who have a job that would sustain a middle-class lifestyle and family 15 years ago that now simply doesn't. And meanwhile, at the very top, you just see this super surge, and you see, you know, the widening of this chasm that means really they're living in a totally different economic sphere, but also social and cultural one.
And polls indicate that most Americans, the majority of Americans, go along with the president when he says we should tax the wealthier Americans. And yet it doesn't seem to have had much of an impact during this presidential campaign.
That's right. Apart from creating real pushback against the president from the millionaire and billionaire class. You know, as you said, Leonard, the rhetoric, I think, from the president has been quite mild on those issues. But when you talk to the super rich, when you talk to the plutocrats, that wouldn't be the impression you get. You know, when you talk to them, they really feel the president hates them. They compare him to an abusive husband and themselves to the battered wives. They compare him to Hitler. They really feel that even these mild comments by the president constitute all-out war.
But the wealthy, especially those in finance, have done quite well in the wake of the 2008 recession. Why did they feel like battered wives?
Well, this is the great mystery and the great paradox, because if you actually look at people's incomes, President Obama has been a better president for the plutocrats than he has been for the middle class. Now, I think that there are a lot of objective factors to do with that, but if you just want to look at who won and who lost, the plutocrats should love him.
Did any of them originally support him?
Yes. Yes, he had a lot of support in 2008, partly because, you know, he comes from the right background and he has the right technocratic cast of mind. But I do think that what is the huge challenge, and President Obama has started to ask these questions, is really since the Reagan era, it's been really fantastic to be rich in America. And there's been this equation of sort of business success with civic and public virtue. So you weren't only being a successful businessman, merely being a successful businessman. You were building America. You know, capitalists were the heroes of our time. And in a way, your virtue could be measured by the size of your bank account. For the president...
This sounds like Calvinism.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, although Adam Smith was also very worried, actually, about the poor and about... I mean, Adam Smith is quite interesting on the rise of the plutocrats and how he was concerned capitalism would create this. But I think, you know, even the mild comments by President Obama are suggesting that, you know, maybe what's great for a global private equity firm is not ideal for the U.S. middle class, and that is profoundly threatening.
Well, the president's supporters reacted with glee when that video of Mitt Romney claiming that 47% of Americans don't pay income tax and want a free ride was released. But that doesn't seem to have had much of an impact either. Are Americans not have they bought into something else, or did they just ignore this sort of thing?
Well, I actually think the 47% video remark, I think that that did have an impact. And part of the impact is maybe measured in that turn towards the moderate Mitt that we saw in the debates.
Well, the he made that speech in a closed meeting with wealthy people, the people you're calling plutocrats. Do they pretty much share that attitude?
Well, you know, they absolutely do. And I was really I felt sorry for Governor Romney when that remark became public, to be honest with you, because it didn't feel to me at all like a gaffe. It was something, and, you know, I have several passages in my book of people making very similar remarks. They get the percentages slightly different. I have one guy who says it's 46% who are on the dole, another guy who says it's 50%. But yeah, this is a truth universally acknowledged among the super elite.
Despite the fact that it was pointed out that many of the people we're talking about are in the military or on Social Security. So we're really talking about a much smaller percentage on the dole. And many of those people are looking for jobs, aren't they?
Absolutely. And let's not forget that big business often benefits from government, too. I mean, the single biggest welfare check, if you want to call it that, that's been written recently is the TARP. And I think that was the right thing to do. But if you want to talk about who's benefited from government largesse, Wall Street is at the front of the line.
My guest is Chrystia Freeland. Her latest book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. It's published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Chrystia Freeland, who is the digital editor at Thomson Reuters. She spent years at the Financial Times, both in New York and in London, and was the deputy editor of Canada's The Globe and Mail. She's reported for the Financial Times, The Economist, The Washington Post. And her latest book is called Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. It's published by the Penguin Press. Do the people you call the plutocrats feel that they are receiving a reasonable share?
Yeah, I think they do. I think
well, you
that
speak
they,
to them.
I do speak to them. Yeah, I mean, I think that they certainly are conscious of being the beneficiaries of this tremendous economic change that we're living through. I mean, I think they tend to believe that they are the beneficiaries because they're really good, because they're good at taking risks, because they're really smart, because they work really hard.
And
that's not untrue.
And if Obama wins, then as abused spouses, their status will be in peril?
Well, you know, it's going to be very interesting because one of the things which was different this time, a big difference between 2012 and 2008, is that Obama really didn't get much support among the plutocrats. And actually, especially the big Wall Street guys who backed him in 2008, they didn't get courted in the way that they had expected after his election. So if Obama wins, he will be in the interesting position of not owing these guys very much.
Well, he did save the big banks, didn't he?
But he wasn't as nice to them as they thought he should be, truly. I'm not exaggerating. They really feel this way.
Well, you say that they feel that they have earned their position, but you also say that wealthy business people try to create moats around their sources of wealth to ensure that others won't enter.
That's right. And
why do they do that? Why does it bother them that somebody else might become as wealthy as they are? Didn't we celebrate the entrepreneurial spirit only a few years ago?
For sure. But the point about moats, I think, is a good one. It's a famous line from the 2007 letter to shareholders that Warren Buffett wrote. His point was the best business is a business with a natural moat where competitors can't threaten you. And I think it's pretty easy to understand why that's the case. And that is what all businesses seek. I think the danger of a plutocracy, the danger of this huge income disparity, is with this sort of extreme wealth comes potentially a louder political voice. And inevitably, it's just a human tendency, that louder political voice will be used to lock in privilege. We saw it with financial deregulation.
That's all that loud voice you're saying is through lobbying. Now, lobbying seems to me to be a reasonable thing. It's a chance to get your side heard. But you're suggesting that there's an inequality there as well?
Yeah, there's an inequality in how much money can be spent by lobbying by people with different amounts of money to spend on it. And I think we've really seen that with the amount of money sort of flooding into super PACs in this election. Again, it will be interesting if the president is reelected because it will suggest that even that amount of money didn't work.
Has capitalism generally been successful in creating wealth across class lines?
Absolutely. I mean, look, and this is where I do think the left and progressives need to be much more thoughtful in their analysis of all of this than they have been in the past. I think that it's really important to be clear that, you know, we've been speaking, Leonard, about the Industrial Revolution. It's important to be clear that was a very good thing. You know, thank goodness for that.
But there was child labor. There were all sorts of other things. There was racism in America.
Right. But isn't it better that we had it than not? The key point, though, is, and so sometimes when I talk to economists about what's happening today, we talk about the parallel with the Industrial Revolution, and they say, so it's all going to be okay in the end, right? And what we have to remember, though, is for the Industrial Revolution to actually work out, for the things like child labor to end, it took two world wars, communist revolutions in China and in Russia, a Great Depression, and in the United States, the Progressive Era, trust busting, and the New Deal. It took all of these new social and political institutions to equal things out, to allow society and political institutions to adapt to these new economic forces. And my closing argument in my book is we, in the United States, but actually in the whole world, are living through an economic transformation of comparable scale. And we do need to have an adjustment which is comparably ambitious. Otherwise, our society is going to be torn apart in the way it was in the 19th century.
Is there anyone out there who seems to have an overview that might help us get through this transition? Because it seems to me what we have instead is just a tug of war going on.
Yeah, I think it is a tug of war. And I think that part of the problem is we have been slow to accept that something is going on that is really deep and profound in the economy. And that's partly because, you know, the baseline is a lot higher than it was in the 19th century. In the 19th century, if you fell through the cracks, you died. So I think the social pressure is much less. And the other point, and we sort of touched on this a little bit earlier, Leonard, is there's sort of a cognitive capture of the entire political and intellectual elite. You know, Barack Obama went to Harvard Law School, just as many of the plutocrats do. And there is sort of a way of thinking, which I think was part of the reason we had the financial crisis. And the chief economist of Citigroup actually is the guy who came up with this term of cognitive capture. We all tend to think in the same way and tend to see the world, the people who are in charge, from these sort of gilded heights of the 1% or the 0.1%. And so I think there hasn't been enough really deep thinking about what are you going to do about the hollowed out middle class?
Why didn't that happen with FDR? After all, if anyone came from the super wealthy, it was FDR.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I think one of the paradoxes of today's super elite, which was one of the things that surprised me in the research for my book, is this elite is different from that of FDR's generation because it's mostly not inherited wealth. This is mostly a group described by Emmanuel Saez, the Berkeley economist who is the great student of income inequality in the world, as the working rich. And you would think instinctively, I assumed that would mean a greater sympathy for people lower down, but actually sometimes it means less sympathy. There's a tendency to say, I did it myself. You can too. You're a schmuck.
Mm-hmm. What we're calling the meritocracy.
Yeah.
My guest is Chrystia Freeland. Her latest book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. It's published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. It's the only guest I've ever allowed to call me a schmuck on the air.
It wasn't you, Leonard. It was the plutocratic attitude to non-plutocrats.
What is the Kuznets curve?
The Kuznets curve is a curve proposed by an economist, Kuznets, on what the shape of income inequality would be in societies. And he thought that we would hit a point once we got to a certain level of economic advancement where we would level out.
That's not happening.
Seems not to be happening.
It did happen after World War II.
That's right.
And we were going through a big economic boom then because people didn't believe in the meritocracy at the time?
No. That period after World War II is really interesting. As you say, it was actually a period when you had both really strong economic growth but actually a compression of income inequality. It was a period when the society grew together, and it was also – perhaps not incidentally, a period when taxes at the very, very top were higher than people can even imagine. You know, in the 50s, the upper top marginal tax rate was above 90%. Imagine a politician suggesting that.
Did people ever pay 90%?
Well, certainly the super rich weren't paying an effective tax rate of 14% as they are today. So, and what I would say about that was the period when you had the social and economic reaction to those adjustments to the Industrial Revolution we were talking about, the Progressive Era and the New Deal. And that was how they sort of flowed through the pipes into the broader economy.
And when did that change? In the 70s?
In the 70s. The real
when Jimmy Carter was president?
Late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Carter into Reagan. So we started deregulating.
Exactly. Deregulating, and look, I think there were also forces happening in the world economy. You started to see in the 80s, much more pronounced in the late 80s and early 90s, this wave of liberalization, collapse of communism. I think that's actually an absolutely crucial point, both in terms of how we think about the world. You know, it made a centrally planned economy something that was off the table. And also it opened up huge parts of the world that could join the world economy, not just the Soviet Union, but also India and China.
How does the income share of the top 1% today compare with 1970?
Huge difference. So in the late 70s...
We're talking about 40 years or so?
Yeah. Yeah. So in the late 70s, the top 1% took even less, between sort of more like 30 years. The top 1% accounted for about 10% of the income. Today, that figure is above 20, you know, between 20 and 25%. And what is really striking is if you look at the top 0.1%, so 10% of the 1%, they are close today to hitting 8% of the income. So think about that. Today, the top 10% of the 1% is roughly where the entire 1% was in the 70s.
But you said one of the differences is that today, most of the people at the top do not have inherited wealth. And we like to think of America as a place where you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But contradictorily, we're hearing that that's becoming harder and harder.
Well, one is the measure of what happened to get us here, and the other is where we are today going forward. So it is the case, and I think that this is the thing that actually should worry everybody, no matter which side of the political spectrum you place yourself in. It is simply, you know, an economic fact that social mobility is hardening. Those arteries are furring up in the U.S., and that social mobility today, according to many measures, is lower in the U.S. than it is in Western Europe or in Canada. Having said that, especially at the very top, there is, I think, a sort of a winner-take-all phenomenon that means if you are very lucky If you're great at taking risks, if you work really hard, you can get there. Now, having said that, I would also like to stipulate, Leonard, that if you wish to be a billionaire, it is helpful to be born into an affluent family.
Or to have good connections. So are American elites today more similar to their counterparts in emerging markets like Russia or China or India than to average Americans?
Well, I think that they have increasingly more and more connections with each other than they do with their communities back home. There is sort of Eric Schmidt, who is now the chairman of Google, described to me with a certain amount of irony the sort of international circuit that exists for the 0.1% or maybe the 0.01%. And he said, well, you know, you have to go to Davos and you have to go to Aspen and you should probably go to the Oscars and maybe the Chelsea Flower Show in London. So they hang out together. They do business deals together. They go on holiday in the same places. And they have a shared set of economic interests.
And they, but there used to be a couple of major global cities. Now that has broadened?
I think so. I mean, I think the list, you know, I think New York is definitely one of the global cities.
It
so
remains
is London.
Such.
Absolutely. But what's interesting is New York actually is becoming more of a global city than it was before. So the building, which is now known to New Yorkers as the one that had the crane whose boom got bent. 157 is also known as the Plutocrat's Palace. This was a building that was marketed expressly at the global super elite. The top 11 floor, I think it's the top 11 floors, started at 50 million. And the amazing thing is the idea was that many of the people buying these fabulous apartments, it would be one of several homes and they wouldn't live there all year round.
Now, the cover of your book has a woman leading her son in a suburban driveway to a private jet. I don't know whether she's meant to be the wife of a plutocrat or a plutocrat herself, but it made me wonder whether women are making it into the ranks of the super rich in the same way that the men are.
I'm sad to say she's meant to be the wife of a plutocrat. And one of the things that was very striking for me, Leonard, was how few women there are. In the sort of real high altitude of money and power in the world. I am an ardent feminist, and I had intended to have a chapter on the women plutocrats. And what I discovered was there are almost none. And
despite the fact that you point out that being born rich is not a trust fund, more important actually is going to the right school. Women are going to the right schools, aren't they?
I know. No, it's a mystery, and it was something that made me quite sad. I spoke to – and I don't have a definitive answer as to why there are so few and really stunningly few women at the extreme heights of wealth and income. I spoke to one well-known, I won't tell you his name because he wouldn't let me, but one very well-known private equity tycoon about this. And I made exactly the point you make, Leonard. I said, look, you know, women are going to these great schools. What's the story? And he said, you're absolutely right. Women are just as smart as men. They're just as good at math. I hire a lot of female analysts. They work just as hard. They're great. He said, but you know what? They lack the killer instinct. They will not go for the jugular. And that's why they just don't do as well.
And the ones who do wind up running for senator or governor. We have a lot of bright people who flocked to Wall Street in the past. That's happening less now, isn't it?
Well, interesting. I mean, there has been a slight fall off, and there are certainly fewer jobs on Wall Street than there were before the financial crisis. We're seeing the banks shrink. Interestingly, though, even as we're seeing layoffs, we're sort of seeing a winner-take-all economy on Wall Street as well. You're either laid off, but the guys who are left are still doing extremely well.
Just one more thing. You wrote a book, as I said earlier, about what happened in Russia after the fall of communism. Now, Russia does have a very limited economy, floated largely by gas and oil. Why are there so many billionaires in the former Soviet Union?
Because it has a lot of natural resources, and because in the mid-90s, the Russian government essentially gave away the natural resources really essentially actually just gave them away.
Well, they said that the alternative, they said the alternative was to put them up for sale and Westerners would come in and they would have pretty much taken over the Russian economy.
It wasn't actually so much fear of a Western takeover. The reason that the Loans for Shares deal happened in 1995-96 was fear that the communists would win that presidential election. And it was essentially to lock in the support of the oligarchs. And, you know, the result is, I think, one of the most unjust economies in the world.
Chrystia Freeland is the digital editor at Thomson Reuters. She's been at the Financial Times and written for that newspaper, along with the Globe and Daily Mail, The Economist, The Washington Post. Her latest book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else, is published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for letting me talk about my book. I really enjoyed it.